I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Are you ready?
Hey guys, come on, bring it in.
Clap your hands now.
When someone like Jamie Cullum says this,
I look at him as someone who has inspired me as much as any musician has. You think you've got the most records? You think you know the most about Blue Note Records? Giles knows more about Blue Note Records than Don Was does.
Right. He runs the label.
Right.
Well, we just had to hang.
Watch what happens when the people catch wind of the water hit.
Hi, I'm Gregory Porter. Welcome to The Hang. Liquid spirit. Each episode, I sit down with friends, idols, inspirations of mine to shoot the breeze about life, music, love, anything and everything that makes its way back to art.
And I suddenly saw, this is jazz.
Yeah.
I became obsessed by this music and yeah, I was on a mission. So I set up my own pirate station by the age of 15.
Wow.
My guest today is DJ, label boss, and tireless jazz champion, Mr. Giles Peterson.
When I can play a jazz waltz at the end of the night, having played electronic music and bonkers UK bassline music and get a certain amount of spirituality at the dance, it doesn't get any better than that. That's why I continue to do my job, to find that moment.
And so here is The Hang. Come on, bring it in.
So tell me about this this podcast.
It's called The Hang, but it's anything really, just a good conversation, but heading in the direction of creating and making art or keeping it alive or supporting it or, yeah. So it's just a conversation on that level. So it's been, it rolls along with, but big personalities who have something to say about the thing that they're in.
Okay.
And you are that.
Let's hope I am.
We're at the Cheltenham Jazz Festival, and there is sound checks going on. There are, you know, massive troops of people walking on top of us and around us. So some of the noises that you hear, that'll be that. But we're here with Giles Peterson, hanging.
How many times have you done Cheltenham?
This is, I think, like maybe seven times. I'm artistic curator at this time, so you know they got me everywhere this time. But it's been amazing. It's an amazing little festival, you know, village of niceness that I like. I have always felt like the DJ plays an essential part, you know. You are the practitioner of the medicine that we make. You know, it's very, very important. And I think what I love about my career is there's been something off of every album that somebody, if it wasn't intentionally by me, somebody has taken it and made it to get it to some ears of some people who want to move their body, who want to dance. So DJs all over the world, you know, I hear so much from DJs all over the world, a ton from South Africa. And I love
it. It's amazing over there, isn't it?
Yeah. I love it. And I get, you know, I get all these messages from the first record, from 1961. I love that. So I love the fact that I've been able to get into this DJ culture, this dance culture that happened quite smoothly, naturally, and quite frankly, damn it, I like to dance, you know? So yeah, it's been cool. And now in jazz, you don't have to apologize for that. Yeah, which is cool. And you've, whether you know it or not, are instrumental in that. I remember being at St. Nick's Pub and this British girl that was living in New York comes into the club one night and she's jumping up and down. She's like, you know, Giles is playing you. And I was like, Giles who? Giles Peterson is playing you. I was like, she says, it's really important. It's really big. And I was like, okay. And I had heard of you, but she just called you Giles. You know, you only need a first name. So
it's a unique thing. I mean, definitely. It's funny you talk about South Africa as well, because as a collector, South Africa, some records would only come out of outside of America. They'd be released in South Africa, but nowhere else. So as a collector, I'd pick up records with South African labels on them from jazz musicians. So I remember getting some rare John Lucian records and some John Hendrix records in South African pressings because I couldn't get the American pressings. So that always made me curious about how come these records from the 70s and 80s were coming out in South Africa. And I mean, of course, someone like Rodriguez, you know, who became a star over there and then sort of was rediscovered again, having come out of America and Detroit, but didn't make it, did he, at Sussex? And then suddenly, you know, some soldiers start playing him in, you know, in the Rhodesian War or something in South Africa. And the story came back and he became, you know, they rediscovered him. But from my point of view, what's interesting is that I think I was thinking about this yesterday because I interviewed Dennis Bevel for my radio show recently, and he's a great reggae producer in the UK. We were talking about his involvement and his history, and he's from Barbados and came over to the UK in the 60s, and he was telling me all about the sound system culture that happened in England, which led on to the Notting Hill Carnival, and this kind of history that the UK, London in particular, and cities like Birmingham as well, have got with Caribbean culture.
Yeah.
And the impact that that has had on popular culture is difficult to say how incredibly important it's been, you know, whether it's punk music, you know, all the punks, and punk was a hugely radical music that changed everything. And if you look to, you know, The Clash and The Sex Pistols and you ask them, Public Image Limited, what their influences were, it's all reggae. You know, it's all reggae. They were into reggae, you know. So this guy, and so this is what makes Britain quite interesting, this fascinating relationship with music from beyond its shores.
Yeah.
And this kind of multiculturalism that's happened, which is a different kind of multiculturalism to what happened in America. So that I'm very grateful for as a Londoner. I'm French, actually, half French, half Swiss, lived in London from a very young age. I mean, I wouldn't consider myself English, French, or Swiss. I'd consider myself a Londoner, you know. I wish there was a passport for that.
There should be, yeah.
Yeah, there should be, especially right now. But
I'm a Londoner. I haven't seen this before.
That's the passport. But yeah, so we have a responsibility right now with the way the world is, the planet is, the way, you know, business is. We were asking me the question. We were both at this television show yesterday, Jazz 625, which was quite a major platform for the music on a free-to-view platform. You know, it doesn't really happen anymore on television. I mean, you have to go on online, but this is the BBC doing a live 90-minute jazz show. Difficult, because they had to tick a lot of boxes to make sure that everyone's happy. As we know, jazz is a pretty open-ended word and it means different things for different people. But this was an opportunity to have Joshua Redman, Gregory Porter, Robert Mitchell, Camilla George play to a new audience, you know, people who wouldn't normally have that window in. So it's an important window. And so these are moments when you can make a difference. It's very easy. I mean, our world, and me as a DJ, and I'm going off at different tangents, but it's interesting because we can always play to the purists, right? We can. That's easy. It's fun. It's great. It's amazing. You're playing at home. But I think the big challenge, which is what you've been amazing at, and I think it's for me, it's the gatekeepers. And I see myself as somebody who opens the door, and people who wouldn't in any way be interested in what I have to offer or what the world of jazz has to offer, I can maybe bring a few in. And I think that's an important responsibility.
Can I call you a gate opener, I would think?
Gatekeepers
usually, you're not good enough.
You're right. I'm the opener. I'm the gate opener. Sorry, I missaid that. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, they're the roles. I mean, I didn't just get into you know, Black Noir by Gregory Porter by mistake. I needed to find... I had to get there, you know, and from the UK side, you know, I probably had to go through a few gates before I ended up at that gate, but I needed those openers to initially, you know, find the way.
Mm. I've found the UK audience to be, you know, really interesting. They have healthy ears, and I can sense that there's a, when I came here, just when you just have a camaraderie with the fans or people who are first listening to you for the first time, there was a great appreciation for soul music. Yeah, and I love it.
I mean, it was interesting with you as well, because I know that when 1960 Watt suddenly blew up, I think from what I understand, it was like a lot of the DJs from the soul clubs that were playing it.
Yeah.
It suddenly just got picked up, and it was enough people, because these days it's difficult to break out, because there's so many different little scenes and bubbles that you need everyone at once, or you need one scene to really be powerful behind your music. And with you, it was the catalyst that got you out of just the straight ahead jazz world into something else.
Yep.
A new world had discovered you, who loved soul music and jazz and that kind of mixture of all of it. And suddenly it was a hit record, and you could play that record anywhere, and it was, there was enough of different types of people mm-hmm. that would dance to it and mm-hmm. love it. I mean, it must have been amazing for you when that suddenly started, when you started seeing that. When did you start seeing that there was an effect? Did you was it at the gigs, or did you start getting...
Well, there used to be this group that used to come to St. Nick's Pub. This is when we were, this is before the record was made, when we did this song. And they would constantly be wiggling in the corner when we did St. in 1960 Watt. And some DJs would come in. There's a DJ I call Fumi and Krumi. He was like, man, yeah, you got to get that to the DJs, Porter. And I was like, It's coming. You know, we'll see what happens, but something's coming. And anyway, yeah, once we made the record, you must know about this Soul Summit that happens in Brooklyn. They play dance music, soul music. And I had been coming to this dance party that they have on Sundays for years, but being just like this little, you know, shy dude that did his little shoulder bops in the corner in Brooklyn. Then, you know, 1960 Watt was out, and then they started to play it out there. And all of a sudden, people started to recognize me and notice me. And to the point where for a while I couldn't go out there and dance, because people were like, my tune would come on, and they're like, you know, there's a bunch of selfies would start taking place. And I was like, wow, I never imagined such a thing, you know. And even now, it's been played over the years. And now they're saying, man, you know how many times or the things that have happened, you know, spinning that record? I was like, no, I have no idea. So things happen with music. You make this music or you play this music, and it creates a life for people. And when you step into their equation, sometimes they're reminded, and sometimes I go into Brooklyn now and people just grab me by the neck. Yo, Porter! And I don't even know these people, and grab me by the neck. And, you know, it's like, it's just amazing the power of music and its ability to go into these different environments and make people feel a certain way. And I think my desire and what I've been steeped in, if we can... I want to get to as many of those people as I can, you know. Yes, there is something to say about purity, and some people have to stay home and stick to one thing and one ting, 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 and do that. I honor those people that do that. I think Wynton Marsalis is extraordinary. A blues man that never steps away from his, you know, three-string guitar. I respect that, you know, and I love it. But those, you know, those people that can pick and pull from all of that are necessary as well. And in a way, that's its own purity. The purity of gathering bits and pieces and creating something else out of it. And I'm glad I'm in a time where I can do it, and I've found enough markets around the world that it's acceptable. So
the big sort of dilemma for you, I think, was how come I'm not as well known in America as I am in the rest of the world. It must have been odd for you. You're on Blue Note, and finally it's beginning to come through, right?
Yeah.
I get the sense, I mean, you know, beyond the localities. I mean, It's on a major... Was that why the Nat King Cole album was an important sort of way to...
You know, it's as strategic as the Nat King Cole thing seems, that is just as soulful and as important as Be Good or Water for me, because it literally was the environment of my childhood, not with a 70-piece orchestra, you know, but I think the consideration of commercialism, you know, wasn't even there in making that record. It was, you know, Nat's music really was kind of the foundation and the start and the environment of my house, and that music did speak to me in the absence of my father. And but yes, it did get me to some more ears in the U.S. And I think the interesting thing that's happened is the radio edits that they've done for some of my music. They finally got around to playing it on US radio. And then people go back and it's like, oh, okay, yeah, there's something there. You know, people are trying to figure out. I think Americans sometimes are really late on a few things, you know. You know, it's like, you guys will be enjoying it over here in the UK or in, you know, in wider Europe. And then they're like, oh, okay, yeah, okay, we get it, yeah. Yeah. But it's kind of always been that way with jazz, though.
That's certainly one thing. But then when I was in the States for the Winter Jazz, I go there most years now, and I was there for the Roy Hargrove tribute wake event at Kennedy Center. Yeah. And I suddenly saw, oh my gosh, this is a proper tribute. You could never get this anywhere else. This was like 100 years of depth, and the people that came out, and the this is jazz.
Yeah.
You know, this is it.
Yeah.
I was like, we're just little children at the back, you know, just doing having our view of how it is, you know, because you can't, you know, this is your art form. It's the, you know, it's, and I saw.
Wasn't that heavy, man? That was heavy.
Remarkable evening. And I was just humbled at the sight, you know, just like round the back there, just there sitting down, watching everyone just doing it modestly, really humility throughout.
That's it. It was the humility and the realness comes out, because when there's a single cause, you know.
Yeah. Because it's really funny, because jazz in England, commercially speaking, is less interesting, I think, than France or Germany. Germany and France have had a healthier relationship with it somehow. In England, I think that because of rock and roll having such a dominant force, any other music was very out in the fringes, which made the people who were behind these musics really passionate. And so almost like we were the outsiders, and you've always got to be careful of outsiders, because they're never going to go down. They're going to keep going. And micro scenes will start coming out. And for me, for example, all the years that I was running record labels in the 80s and 90s, it was always in the shadows of pop and rock, and trying to get my music to more ears. And over the last few years now that things have changed and people are more open-minded, and the media and the internet has allowed people to make their own choices, there's less control by the machine.
Yeah.
Do you get a chance in these, having been doing what you've been doing for quite a while now, when there are these moments, these intense moments, you're walking out on stage at the Albert Hall, or you've got a big live television show, to be able to enjoy that moment. You know, that's the thing I'm trying to do as much as I can now, because you spend so much time being nervous about it or being sort of that sort of anticipation, so that actually when the moment happens, you can't really enjoy it. And I felt that when I saw you at Albert Hall, especially the second, I didn't go the first time, but I remember when I saw you at the Albert Hall, you walked on there and I could tell that you were absolutely loving every moment of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's not so easy. I think people don't always understand that.
No, it takes a minute to get there. You start to learn to, once you realize that you know, your thing has been accepted and you just have a comfort in what it is that you're going to do. Now, still, there's plenty of things to get nervous about. And
have you got a trick? Have you got, for example, yesterday you were saying you were really enjoying sort of just chatting with all the musicians and that side of it. Of course, it was amazing. Mm-hmm. But then you've got a film director, you've got a producer, and you've got the camera. Everyone's going, wow, you got to be sitting there. You got to talk here.
The thing that I've come to with everything, with my style, with my sound, musically, with how I even approach, you know, working in media, is being organic and saying, this is me, Gregory, son of Ruth. There's nothing I can do but be me. And I think the most authentic me is probably the best foot to put forward. Now I can BS you with, you know, like GP, the sexy dog, you know, or what, or oh no, you know, because I'm black, I'm all the way hip hop, you know, I could do all of that.
Yeah.
But the most authentic me is a little bit of all of it. Mm. So it's a little bit of gospel, a little bit of blues, a little bit of soul, a little bit of, you know, intellectual yet soulful listener, you know. So I think if I'm just organic, it'll come across the right way. Mm. Yeah. When I try to put on some crap, I'm embarrassed by it, and I don't ever look at it or when it comes out on YouTube or something like that. So if I'm just me, then it works.
Are there bits out there that you would avoid?
There always is. You always do something. You know, there's always something. You know what's funny? I was joking. I was at this party in Germany, this awards ceremony, and then the reporter. There was a 2-minute moment of me just doing a total joke, stepping outside of myself. And that's the clip that he used, you know, and which leads me to say, oh, you can never trust journalists, you know, because sure. I mean, I left him saying to him, you know, that was a complete mess joke that I just did there. So, you know, don't use that. Next thing I know, that's the first thing. Oh. So I did my best to try to get a hold of him and tell him, I said, man, take that down. It was a joke. and they finally did, but it was up for a long time. Wow. I was totally embarrassed. I was trying to be like an arrogant artist who completely deserves everything that he gets, you know? And, and yeah, it's just not me.
Humor doesn't always translate, does it?
Yeah. It was like, but he knew, he was like, ooh, I got something here, you know?
Right.
Gregory's lost his humility and now he's turned into a diva. And it's like, okay, all right, you made a splash. Now, can I have my dignity back? Thank you. But
you were brilliant that day. I invited you. I don't know if you remember this, when I was doing a Dingwalls party on a Sunday afternoon. This was a few years ago now. And you came on, and talking of humility and just coming on and doing your thing. It was an unbelievable moment. Yeah. One of the great moments of my DJ career, just to have Gregory Porter take the mic and no one knew that you were there that day.
Yeah.
That was remarkable.
It was interesting. As I came in and the bartender was treating me kind of mean, a bit rude. I was trying to get a beer. And then I went, took my beer and kind of went over to a section. And the people over there were like, not really giving me any space. And I wanted to say, well, I need a little room because I think I'm about to go up on stage, you know. And so then I was sanctioned by, you know, Giles Peterson and Patrick Forge, and you guys invited me up on stage, and boom. Then the people were like, oh, yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was amazing because the club was warm, and
it was a good time.
It was a good time, and it's some. I mean, that is, yeah, man, it was just really cool. The faces. I felt like I was in a movie because the faces, the people. You know, there's people. They were there, older people. I could tell it's like they've been dancing for 30 years, you know? They've been grooving and enjoying like this for 30 years. The mix of races is dope to see at a thing like that. You know, sometimes you have to step out of yourself and step out of the circle of what you're in to know how special what you have is. So I stepped into this movie scene, you know, and seeing these brothers and sisters in hats twirling to whatever the DJ was spinning, just as long as it's cool. Jazz, soul, 70s soul music. And man, it was just cool, man. It's just absolutely cool. Yeah. And I'm glad to step in and be part of it. Yeah. So yeah, that's you know, if I get to make a movie, you know, we'll recreate that scene.
I'll be the DJ. I hope.
Yeah.
Hey guys, you're listening to The Hang. Hit subscribe or follow on your podcast thingamajig of choice to get every episode of The Hang fresh off the presses.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The roots is something that I'm always fascinated with. You know, I talk about mine all the time. And what are yours? How did you get those big ears of yours? And you said you're a Londoner. But yeah. what does your passport say?
My passport says French and Swiss. And mm-hmm. My parents brought me over from France because my dad was an engineer working for a Swiss company. And he just put us into South London and put me into the French Lycée in London. And I had a French upbringing as a stranger in London around the French circle. But when I was 11, my parents decided to put me into an English school. And at that stage, I had to suddenly shift and relearn to write because my writing was too squiggly. And I had to understand the etiquette of being a young boy in an English boys' school, and that was very different to being in a mixed French school. And suddenly I had to belong to a musical tribe, and I had the choice of being a skinhead, a punk, a rocker, or a soul boy. And in my school there were three soul boys, and one of them's sister had some really great records. And going around his house, I discovered Earth, Wind & Fire and Bobby Caldwell and Stevie Wonder and Cameo and all these groups. And through them, that was my doorway in, and I found my identity. And then I started going to these pubs and bars that would play this music, and I was hearing this music on one radio show on BBC Radio London, a local station on a Saturday called the Robbie Vincent Show, and a pirate station called Radio Invicta 92.4, the first soul station in London. Soul Over London was their tagline.
Okay.
And I used to listen to that on a Sunday. The only place I could hear this pirate radio station was in my bathroom, because that was the only place that I could actually get a signal. And I'd be there sitting.
Remember those days, man? Oh, you know, you'd take a coat hanger and.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
And I just wanted, I became obsessed by this music and by this world that I didn't know anything about. And yeah, I was on a mission. My electric railway set that was in the. In the garden shed, suddenly disappeared when I was 13. And one weekend, my parents went away to somewhere on their wedding anniversary. They'd left me at home on my own with my sister and brother, and they got back a few days later. The electric railway set had gone, and in the place of it was a twin deck, double mixer, turntable with a cassette player in the middle and a microphone. And I bought a transmitter and a little pirate transmitter. So I set up my own pirate station by the age of 15.
Wow.
Where I would play out these little radio shows that I would record in my garden shed. And eventually my dad would help me put the aerials up and broadcast. And that's it. So I just became this guy. And so by the age of 16, 17, I was getting known to be a guy who played jazz and soul records. young guy, and had his own pirate station, and that was my journey beginning as that person. So I'd earn my money by DJing in bars, and what I would do, of course, like any jazz musician or anyone, I'd sort of build a little following, and I'd say to the clubs and the pubs and the venues, I'd say, look, give me a gig, I'll bring 30 people. They were like, fine. So then I brought a crowd, I played records and got a reputation. And I was the guy who played jazz.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when I was 15 or 16, I'd go, I think maybe, yes, I was 16. I went to a weekender. You've done these.
Yeah.
On holiday, in these like, you know, disused holiday camps on the North Sea. Nothing happens all year round apart from, you know, and so certainly nothing happens there in November. It's like... They're amazing, and you get in, and 5,000-6,000 people from all around the country would come and listen to their favorite DJs. And there I was, 16, going to Caister in Norfolk, and at the main room they were playing all the big disco, jazz, funk records and soul records. But I walked back, and I found another room. Little back room, and it was the jazz room.
Yeah.
And there was about 30 or 40 people dancing in there, and they were brilliant. They were the best dancers. Yeah. They were like, they'd been promoted from the big room where all the kind of, you know, where the masses were, but the best were in the back room, and they were dancing to Lee Morgan.
Yeah.
And they were dancing to Chick Corea, and yeah. they were dancing to the Fania All-Stars.
Yeah.
John Coltrane.
Yeah.
I remember hearing... The Night Has a Thousand Eyes. Bob Jones, the DJ, was playing The Night Has a Thousand Eyes by John Coltrane. I was 16,
yeah.
maybe 17. Art Blakey, Night in Tunisia. And there were these guys that looked great, danced great. They had the best looking girls.
Yeah.
You know, it was the best crowd was right. there. I wanted to be in there. And suddenly the music was loud. The music was talking to me.
Yeah.
I wasn't in a pub in South London full of, you know, people that I wouldn't relate to. I was with my people listening to my music. So that was really the real sign for me. And mm-hmm. those are the guys who showed me that. Funnily enough, we're here with Joshua Redman. There's a song by Dewey Redman. It wasn't just even straight jazz. They were playing heavy stuff.
Yeah.
I remember Dewey Redman, Unknown Tongues. It's okay. an unbelievable tune.
Okay.
And they were playing that, yeah, YouTube that.
Yeah.
And they were playing that, you know, full power, like you're at a rave and, you know, people dancing to that. And when you see that and you're in that environment, that's really what you were at when you came to Dingwalls that day. That was yeah. the spirit of the dance. And I think the UK, with this club culture and these back rooms that were doing this and pushing it out and finding songs, you know, Polish jazz fusion tracks that just killed it with bass lines, you know, obscure. Who found that stuff? But
yeah.
they would find it, play it. And black kids from Birmingham and Nottingham and white kids, but this crazy mixture of all social groups
yeah.
working class would be at that dance, dancing to those tunes and battling it out like the kids in New York were battling it out to hip hop.
Yeah.
They were doing it to jazz, and they were mixing the old school jazz moves of the Nicholas Brothers and ballet and more classic stuff with, you know, with straight up sort of hip hop style.
Yeah.
So this was quite a unique thing. In fact, people don't talk about it enough because people talk about Northern Soul and they talk about acid house. These little jazz dance battles that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Art Blakey was, there was, I was talking to your manager, Heather, actually, when she was looking after Art Blakey. I didn't know that. And I know that there was a, there's a great television program where Art Blakey came to London with and he kind of fused the jazz, his jazz messengers with the jazz warriors at the time. So that scene of people like Steve Williamson and Courtney Pine and Cleveland Watkiss mixed with people like Jean Toussaint, they were doing a gig which was filmed, and then they got all the dancers out as well from our Dingwalls, from our club scene to do the dance thing. And that was a unique sort of moment of club culture and legacy jazz all coming together to create something very exciting.
Yeah.
Very proud of that period. I think it's a strong part of our culture. And I think it was very much a big part of what allowed you to make a song like Black Nile, you know, or Harold Mayburn, Afro Blue. Yeah. Those are big tunes as well, you know, as well as all your other stuff. But that's a part of Gregory Porter that is a hugely important part of that playlist, which continues to be played by certain DJs around the world.
Wow, that's really rich. That's really, really rich in terms of just music culture. And that's awesome to hear, you know, just the strings of the, you know, of the fabric of where you're coming from. Do you feel a power? Do you feel a power when you're, and there's a room, and you put on a vinyl, and the music just elevates the spirit of people. I mean, you're generally on a platform above all these bodies, and you put on something, and it just starts this thing. Do you feel like a vessel, or do you feel like?
It's an interesting thing being a DJ, being me as a DJ, because I mean different things to different people, so. For example, these parties where we play these heavy jazz tracks to dancers battling it out. That's something I do maybe 3 times a year, 4 times a year, playing to that particular audience. It's amazing. But I can't do that all the time. I'm equally the guy who'll go and play at a big warehouse party in Manchester to 3,000 below 23-year-olds,
right.
You know. And they want to hear me play, you know, heavy, abstract, electronic music. Where I'll slip in a bit of Jackie McLean or a little bit of oddball stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
That's also, in fact, probably more satisfying to me because I'm doing something really new.
Yeah.
But then if someone who wants to hear me playing the more traditional stuff comes to that party, they're really disappointed because they were expecting, you know, Giles to play a version of Moaning or something, you know, and or some Brazilian stuff or some Cuban stuff. So for me as a DJ, it's quite an interesting sort of balancing act when I have to play and work out where I'm at and who I'm playing to. What I found in time is that because I've been in the game as a DJ for nearly 40 years now, I've got a lot of generations who've grown up with me. A lot of them have grown up with me, had children, been out of the game for 20 years. They're all coming back now. I'm seeing them again. They're all back in the room. And then I was, they think that I've just been playing the same stuff for 20 years and I've gone differently. So what I find now is I have to almost, this is why Japan is particularly good for a DJ like me, because you go there and you go, okay, you know you're going to get the right sound. You know you're going to get, you know, the perfect treatment. But also they let me play for 12 hours if I want to. You know, so I'll go on at midnight and I'll still be playing at 8 or 9 in the morning. I mean, I do mega, mega sets.
Wow.
That's when I find that moment when I elevate myself.
Yeah.
When I can play a jazz waltz at the end of the night, you know, if I can play Half and Half by Jimmy Garrison and Elvin Jones to 500 people dancing, or Brother John by Yusef Lateef, at the end of having played electronic music and way out sort of bonkers UK bassline music or whatever. And at the end of the night, I can play that and get a certain amount of spirituality at the dance. It doesn't get any better than that. That's why I continue to do my job, to find that moment. That's the moment, you know, when you can find that. And if you can find it on a new song, of course, it's great. And for me, again, you know, it's that balance between using the grand history of music as a reference and as an ingredient to my overall mix, mm-hmm. which contains a lot of newness. I can't just do the old. I need to be able to find the emerging thing. You know, for me as a broadcaster, you know, it was like when I played Pharrell NERD before anybody had heard it, when I played Gregory Porter or Jose James, or when I played James Blake or Mount Kimby or Amy Winehouse, all these people at the time, they were just demos.
Yeah.
And so that's a super pleasure, and just watching that journey take place from, you know, playing it at the moment.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's a great moment.
Yeah.
It's a great feeling.
You know, I'm reminded of a festival. You talked about understanding your audience and having that audience not dictate, but give you some guidelines as to how you should treat them as a body, as one body in a particular place. I think this is kind of a DJ festival that you did in France, in Set, I think it is.
Yeah, the Worldwide Festival.
Worldwide Festival, right. I remember going out onto the stage, and it's wild, man. Yeah. It's wild. Should I call it a peninsula? Or what would you call that?
Yeah, it's kind of the end of a pier, kind of.
Yeah, the end of a pier. How many bodies?
Well, I mean, I think, funnily enough, when you played that day, it was sort of early in the evening, I think. So yeah. sun was setting.
Sun was setting.
And I'm sure you've played there again, but not for me. You've probably played at the Théâtre de la Mer, which is the other amazing location.
This is particular. Location. This is that particular space where
you played.
Where it was the dance heads.
Yeah. No, you played on the. So we have three stages. There's the beach, there's the theater, and then there's this great thing. We call it the Saint Christ. It's where the lighthouse is at the end of a pier. There's this kind of 5,000 people surrounded by the sea. We go through the night, and actually the morning comes up, and the fishermen are going out to sea while everyone's raving still. It's an amazing sort of experience. Wow. And I mean, it was a wonderful night, the night you played. And it was, again, early days. For Gregory Porter within the club scene in a way. And but again, that festival for me is about really mixing DJ culture with, like, it's like, for me, it's the ultimate radio show where I can listen to my favorite live bands, whether that's Orchestro Polyritmo de Cotonou, African music, whether it's just crazy new electronic Flying Lotus, or whether it's Gregory Porter. For me, it all comes together and it's all linked by amazing DJs.
Well, for me as a performer, maybe we were on a very long tour, maybe a 2-month tour at that time. And I remember physically my body being sore but coming to the stage and seeing the energy. There's a particular energy to, you know, like a dance crowd or a DJ crowd or a crowd that's, or people that just want to have a good time out in the sun. Right. But I said to myself, okay, I got to do a little something, you know, I have to have some levity to my thing and just really enjoy myself and flex. And that's what happened with that set, man. And the crowd,
you caught it. I remember
the crowd was there and they dug it. I remember Chip, somebody took one of Chip's solos and slowed it down into slow motion at that, when he was playing at that festival. And he's just boom, pow. Well, he's almost, there's one point where he hits the piano with two fists. And it was a great experience to have that music with that crowd. Just the way that that you talked about.
Yeah.
This juxtaposition is
I remember Trip awesome. That day. I was sneaking him cigarettes.
Right.
I don't think he was allowed to smoke.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was more than a cigarette. I can't remember.
I recall. I was totally cool with it because it was that kind of vibe.
Yeah, it was fun.
It was
fun.
Great.
I mean, it is difficult. I think that's one thing that I've had to sort of, I mean, any artist, any musician, you know, you're under the spotlight and you have to deliver. And there's a flip side to that in a way. As a DJ, it's interesting. I do a lot of stuff. I go around the world with my MC, my sound man. I need someone with me most of the time just to kind of protect me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think over the year, I mean, it must be difficult. I mean, as a jazz musician, it's the same, right? I mean, I don't know what's your mental health sort of?
I need quiet before a performance and I need a little downtime after a performance. And I take it. It doesn't have to be an extended period of time. It may be just 15 minutes but I kind of like a little alone time to assess. In terms of like a personal handler who's guiding me and showing me, people are amused as I go around the world and I don't have anybody, you know.
You got your band.
I have my band, but you know, sometimes you got to separate from them if you're traveling 300 days a year together, you know. I do have my band and they're always there. But it's a funny thing that happens when we get to an airport. We all disperse in different, you know, one goes to eat, one goes to look at watches, one goes to the drugstore. And we're good at convening. Like, let's get together and make this music. There's not a lot of talk before the show. We get together for about 5 minutes before we go onto the stage and lots of joke, and I love to joke before I go out on the stage. I love to make fun of Chip being old or Jamal having big feet or whatever. You know, they're all just things to bring some lightness before we go onto the stage and brotherly energy. So yeah, for me, your quiet time before, just to center myself. It's, you know, and see how my body is feeling, and a little quiet time after, you know, but the time in hotel rooms, I think the loneliness of that, it's two-sided. Now as a writer and artist, I use that loneliness, I write about it. I'm okay with it. It's a thing that happens with somebody who writes about their emotions is like you start to savor pain in a way. It sounds crazy, but you start to like, okay, let me experience this. Oh, what does this broken heart really feel like? What does this loneliness feel like? Now I'm longing to give my son a hug. What is that? Because ultimately it's going to create something. You understand what I'm saying?
Have you coped with the sort of addiction type things? You've never had sort of drinking or drugs or any of that sort of area. Did that ever kind of play with you? Did you have to be careful with it?
No, I never had. Drugs has never been an issue for me. Probably based on my upbringing with my mother, trying to help so many people get off of drugs. So I just saw the downside of it. So when I came to the clubs and I saw the social aspects of drugs, yeah, I saw that. But then I'm the type of person who's like, okay, let me go to the back of the room and see where the problem is. And there's a problem back there. And there'll be a song on the record, the next record, about that problem. It's called 15 Minutes, and it's about that 15 minutes of the break in between sets where people go and do their thing. And the bridge is, these well-dressed gentlemen of the slope They will gladly bring you down fast or slow. But there's one thing I know for sure. At the bottom of the hill, you need another pill to get high. You know, it's kind of an unspoken part of the culture, but it's a part of the culture. And at the little club I worked in, St. Nick's Pub, it was in different areas in New York City. I don't know so much around the world, but yeah, I get offered stuff, but I'm not interested in going there.
It must be quite interesting when you're a musician and you are with musicians who one minute are a certain way and then they have their 15 minutes and they come back on stage. I'm not saying your band, but just generally if you're jamming and suddenly the mood or the something changes.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to...
The drummer's all of a sudden playing in double time all the time. You know, that happened and can happen. You know,
it's the same thing with the DJs. They just pitch the house records. I say they start at 120 and then the DJ's playing at 130 BPM. What happened?
but this is life. I mean, this happens in all forms of people's work life. You know, in ours, because you know, music is social, it's pronounced. You know, I'm not going to or mention any names, but in jazz, I mean, it's known. It's known about. Hell, in rock and roll, it's known. The blues is known, but in the human condition, it's known. So, you know, I don't think it's any different, quite frankly. But it's affected me. And I've seen it. It's affected, quite frankly, it has affected my band. And, you know, I had to make some changes. But, you know, I have such a love for the people that I've played with, currently and even in the past. Even when I sing that lyric, it's a lyric. Even it's just an admonishment to them, just, you know, just be careful. That's what I'm probably saying with the song. Yeah,
that was a great exclusive.
Yeah,
got a nice little piece of your next track. Can I take that for my show, please?
Yeah. You know what, man? Thank you so much. This has been a real hang. The show is called, you know, The Hang, and this has been a real hang. And I've been wanting to have another one since I don't think we've had a good hang since I was on your radio show some years back. But totally good hang. I have just mad respect and love for you and what you do, and thank you so much for being a part of my career. You're in my history, you know, you're in my system already. So thank you so much, Giles Peterson, for being with us and hanging.
Brilliant. I appreciate it. I can't wait to hear the next record.
Oh, yeah. It's on its way. It's on its way, I promise.
Thanks, Gregory.
So there it is. Wow. As always, thank you so much for joining me. Thanks again to my guest, Mr. Giles Peterson.
Clap your hands now.
I'm Gregory Porter, and this has been The Hang, a Cup and Nuzzle production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.